Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Asma Khalid. The last couple of months, it's felt like we've been hearing about a constant onslaught of stories from women about sexual harassment, assault, and rape. From accounts against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein to journalists like former NPR executive Mike Oreskes to politicians on both sides of the aisle, from Minnesota Senator Al Franken to Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, it seems like there is a never-ending blitz, which makes you wonder, is this a moment in which everything is finally going to change? Is this a pivotal moment for sexual culture in America? Jacqueline Friedman has a lot of thoughts about this moment and what cultural shift is needed when it comes to sex. She's a Boston-based writer, activist, and host of the podcast Unscrewed. Her latest book is called Unscrewed: Women, Sex, Power, and How to Stop Letting the System Screw Us All. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for coming in. So you outline in your book that the sexual revolution of the 1960s is essentially unfinished business, right? That even in some ways it failed because it gave what you describe as faux powerment to women, you know, this false sense of empowerment. So what went wrong?
Well, it was mostly led by and for men is what went wrong, right? And it also got co-opted by the market pretty early, by the Hugh Hefners of the world.
I see.
And so what you read, if you read accounts from the time, is something that a lot of women identify with today, which is women saying, sure, it was no longer taboo to have premarital sex, but now there was a lot of pressure to have sex with any guy who wanted to. And they would say, oh, like, you're hung up if you don't want to have sex with me. So lifting that taboo around premarital sex didn't suddenly equip women with the social standing to stand up for their own boundaries and needs and desires and consider themselves subjects of their own sex lives and not just objects for consumption.
I see. And you wrote that, quote, faux powerment is a quintessentially American trap. It proposes to solve a structural societal problem with an individualistic solution. Just claim your sexuality, ladies. The freaker you get, the freer you'll be. But we can't pretend our way to sexual liberation. A woman saying and doing what she wants is not free if she gets punished for it. And a woman who doesn't feel free enough to know what she wants, a woman who is just saying and doing what she thinks she should want, isn't free either. So explain this to me. I mean, it seems like you're saying that the focus has been wrong, that we've been sort of trying to fix a societal problem by focusing on these individuals.
Yeah. So there's all these folks who want to tell women how to become sexually free. And some say, well, you need to be modest and show that you respect yourself by not expressing your sexuality in public, that sexuality has to inherently be a private expression. And then there are other people who say, I'm empowering myself by posting this naked selfie, right? Or, you know, doing these very explicit public expressions of sexuality. But in reality, what we need to look at are the systems and institutions that keep women from full sexual sovereignty. So I tell the story in the book of a young woman who had body image issues. And a friend of hers said, you should get some boudoir photos taken just for yourself, sexy photos, and you'll maybe be able to see how beautiful you are, right? And so she did it, and she did feel better, and she even felt good enough to share them with her boyfriend. And that is sort of the faux empowerment narrative, right? She's empowered now. But what happened after that is they broke up. He posted them to the internet.
Yeah.
And she was deluged with rape and death threats, and to the point that she was suicidal and didn't want to leave the house. So she's not free just because those photos made her feel good. If we still live in a society that where men feel free to trade women's pictures like playing cards without consent, and also where women, if their sexual expressions are public, are punished to the extent that they can't leave their house.
So I get what you're saying, Jacqueline,
yeah.
And I see the sort of nuance that you're describing. But at the same time, I do think there are many ways that things have gotten better for women, right? I mean, I look around our newsroom and you talk to some of the older women who've been in the business for a long time, and the stories they describe are horrific. And, you know, I look and I can go easily buy birth control, get it anytime I want, however I want. And so it does feel like women have real choices both about their work and their sexuality that feel substantively different than what we saw 50 or 60 years ago.
Oh, no question. No question that things are better now in a lot of ways than they were in 1960. But they are not better enough. And a lot of the ways that they've become better have focused on things that make sex easier and more accessible for men. And women happen to benefit from them. If things were truly better, we wouldn't be hearing every day about a new powerful man who sees women in his employ or sphere of influence professionally as sexual toys.
So, Jacqueline, I've got to ask, I mean, what does real empowerment look like? Because in seeing your book, I felt like there was a lot of criticism about what isn't working. And then you did highlight individual cases. But what does the real empowerment look like in your mind?
Yeah, I like to think of it not as empowerment, but actual power.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
That women have power to run our sex lives the way we want to. We're not meant to keep it private and quiet, right? We don't have to pretend we're not sexual, and we're not punished for it. That we should be equally free to dress modestly if that's what we want to do and not express our sexuality in public, and we're not harassed to smile or look sexier for public consumption, or to be as publicly sexual as we want to be, to access abortion, to be powerful in our careers, you know, and not be punished, not be blamed, shamed, and abused.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but isn't there something to be said about, it seems like you don't want there to be a value-based judgment, right, made upon these decisions. But for some communities, it seems, I mean, you talk a lot actually in the book about the religious right, that there is this idea of a value judgment really on sex within the culture overall.
I mean, that's fine for the religious right. If you belong to a religious group that says this is what sex is for and what it's not for and that's what you believe, that's fine when it doesn't impinge on my beliefs, right? My problem is we live in a culture where the definition of what a woman is and can be around sex is determined by the few, mostly white guys, for all of us, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I should also have religious freedom, not just the evangelicals.
Got it. So it seems like what you're describing requires everyone in society to sort of step up here. And it seems sort of utopian, right, to be honest. Like, it's very idealistic. And I hear you. I mean, it feels like, sure, we can hope for the best. But I want to give you, like, a quick analogy, right? Given everything we've heard about what's happened in the context of women, I was having dinner the other night with a friend of mine who's African-American. And she was giving me the analogy of what she tells her young son about how to be safe, right? The conversation she has with him in terms of how he deals with police officers. And she said, look, like, I would love to not have this conversation with him. I would love for him to just be all right and never need to be afraid of the appropriate way to act. But ultimately, she's like, I also want him to survive. And so I'm realistic about the dynamic. And so therefore, I tell him to behave in a certain way. And so it's interesting to me because I do feel like society, we don't, I mean, when I say that in the context of women, I feel like people say like, oh, you're victim blaming. But to some degree, is it just being realistic of the dynamic? And it sounds like what you want is this vision that doesn't exist yet.
Well, but it's not going to exist if we don't make it happen. Culture is Soylent Green. It's made of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the culture we have now around sex is not inherent. It's created by all of us. So, sure, if a parent wants to have a conversation with a child about, you know, safety measures, make sure they're grounded in fact. And that's a whole, you know, thing we could go down. There's a lot of myths out there about what really makes us safer and doesn't. But, you know, I imagine that your friend is also supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement, which is trying to make it so future moms don't have to give future speeches to their kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to accomplish with this book. The world does not need more women saying, here's how we need to be careful and small so nobody hurts us. What we need is a vision of a world that could be different in which we don't need to worry about it.
Got it. And as a part of that, do you feel like there are already good examples of how this is being done?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and as you know, in the book, there's a different example in each chapter.
Mm-hmm.
I spend a lot of time with folks who I think are doing wonderful work, improving the sexual culture in any number of ways. And part of that is to say this work looks a lot of different ways. It depends on who you are and what you're interested in. So I spent time with teenagers in Juneau, Alaska, who are teaching their peers about sex ed because their schools don't do an adequate job of it, and they're doing an amazing job. I spent time with a woman named Cherise Scott, who runs a program in Memphis, Tennessee called Sister Reach, which, among other things, is training clergy to defend reproductive justice using the Bible from a Christian perspective. I spent time up in Maine with a program that's working on helping middle school boys redefine their ideas of masculinity before they get all gelled and hardened. So there's as many different ways to go about making the culture better as there are people. What I hope is that my book will inspire people to get involved in whatever way makes sense to them.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the moment we're in right now. I mean, you described it even earlier. It seems like it's every day. It really almost is every day. You open up your computer and you're just like, oh, gosh, you too.
Today it's Glenn Thrush.
Yes, that is true. do you feel that, I mean, well, actually, let's backtrack a little bit. You talked a little bit about the Anita Hill hearings and how that really opened up your eyes to sexual harassment. And can you describe what it meant to you and why it opened up your eyes?
Yeah. I mean, I had been sexually harassed on the job a couple of years before that. I was a summer job between high school and college, and it was a bankruptcy auction house. So there was a lot of driving around and traveling to like warehouses and things. And the boss who owned the company, you know, just constantly made me feel like a sex object. And everyone around me who tried to help me avoid him. Hmm. Right? Nobody said what he's doing is illegal. There's something you can do about it. He doesn't have to be that way. It really was occasionally in the workforce, you will encounter a guy like this, and here's how to sort of try and protect yourself as best as possible. It felt inevitable. And so when I saw Anita Hill a few years later, you stand up in front of the world and say, this is not acceptable. It's not legal. And it's important enough that it should impact whether or not someone gets to have a seat on the Supreme Court. It was transformational for me. I learned the name sexual harassment, which is not language I
had. You had not heard that before.
No. Mm. But it also just opened my eyes to the fact that, like I said, culture is what we make it. You know, that these behaviors are not inevitable, that these are mostly men making terrible choices.
So after the Anita Hill hearings, right, Jacqueline? I mean, I remember that, you know, now when we look back on that moment, there were all of these employment discrimination cases filed in the immediate year afterwards. There was this rush of behavioral change that people thought was really going to sort of change the cultural conversation. And yet now here we are in, you know, 2017 with a lot of sort of similar problems. When you look at the moment now, does it feel different than what was happening after Anita Hill?
Well, I think social media makes it a lot different. You know, Anita Hill required one woman to take all of the heat and all of the focus, and it really was about this one case. And one of the things that social media and the internet in general is helping us to see is patterns, right? That this is not one bad apple who can be excised, you know, like a cancer. You know, like you get rid of Harvey Weinstein and the problem is solved. Yeah. Hopefully by now, at this point in the news cycle, people are not under that illusion anymore. But I really, I think Anita Hill was super important. And I think that expecting that one cultural moment to have solved this deeply rooted problem by itself is unrealistic, right? I think social change is really kind of glacial. Mm-hmm. And that I think of it in terms of steps forward and sometimes steps back. And I think that the rise of the faux empowerment narrative actually has been a little bit like a half step back, because I think a lot of women in the modern and the more modern era like to think of themselves as powerful and like, I'm good. And like, sex is, we're all cool about sex. And so if somebody at work is making me feel uncomfortable around this, it must be on me. I need to just like toughen up, or I need to be cool or down with this. And it creates this isolation where it's on that individual woman to kind of deal with it instead of saying, hey, this isn't acceptable and you're a jerk, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, that's illegal, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think Anita Hill was a great step forward, and we've done some backsliding since then. And I think I'm hopeful that this moment will be another good
step
forward.
Do you feel like it's different in ways? I mean, beyond the social media, right? Just the conversation that we're having.
Again, I feel like it's a deeper conversation. It's becoming more of a systems conversation and not just about this one case. Mm-hmm. And I think that's materially different.
Jacqueline, I want to ask you about something that is rather personal, but you talk about it as well. And that's the fact that you're a survivor of sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
It was in 1992. You were an undergrad at Wesleyan University. Can you talk to me about both what happened and how you sort of internalized that moment at the time and then subsequently.
Yeah. I was one of the managers of the wrestling team.
Okay.
Which is a whole story we probably don't have time for. And we were at an away meet and we were doing poorly, and the coaches actually bought a bunch of alcohol, and there was a party, and one of the wrestlers followed me back to my room and assaulted me. It's, you know, it's actually not a, it's a pretty standard story, right? It's not that interesting a story, except unless you're me. What that did, I mean, obviously it was terrible, but one of the...
How old were you?
I was 20.
All right.
One of the things it did was it made me question every assumption I had ever had about my body and my sexuality, because I had the assumption before then that I was safe, right? That I was in control of my body, and clearly that wasn't inherently true. And so one of the meanings I've made out of that experience is getting to reconstruct from scratch how I think about sex and my body and autonomy. And I think that really informs the book and all of my work.
So we have a few minutes still left. So let's talk a bit about solutions.
Yeah.
Right? You mentioned that trying to describe a truly unscrewed sexual culture is like trying to prove a negative. And that's what I felt a bit, right? It was a little unclear as to what exactly is the right prescription forward. So help me out.
I mean, the right prescription forward is that women get to have infinite different sexual expressions, and none of them are weighted more highly than the other, or none of them are punished as long as we're not hurting anybody, right? That it's hard to imagine, because we have these tiny boxes right now for women in terms of sex. Like, are you a good girl or a bad girl, right? Are you the virgin or the maiden or the crone or whatever, right? We have these archetypes, but what a truly unscrewed culture would look like is we would assume that women are fully human, three-dimensional people, and that our sex lives are as varied and unique to us as our fingerprints, and we would judge them just as much as we judge each other's fingerprints.
And we get there by?
We get there by everybody picking a thing, right?
Okay.
So whether that means you talk to your school board about how sex ed is being taught in your school, whether that means you take an interest in what the kids in your life are learning about gender, especially the boys, right?
Yeah, and I was going to ask you, I mean, right, so any movement, you think about, like, you think about, you know, the civil rights movement, whatever it was, any movement requires allies. And in this case, it, you know, and you talk a bit about this too, changing the definitions of masculinity, because it's hard to do that if you don't have a lot of male allies.
Yeah. I mean, on some basic practical level, I wish we didn't need men for this project, right? I feel like we would be there already, but we clearly do, right? And so we need men who are in male-only spaces, whether they're parenting boys or hanging out with their friends in the proverbial locker room, right, to say that's not cool when this stuff comes up, when nobody's around and everybody else is assuming it's okay.
And what about, though, for some folks, if it is okay? I mean, I understand what you're saying, right? From your perspective, it's not okay, and you want to create a system where everybody is not judged. But for other folks, and I mentioned this, okay, so let's step back for a second.
Yeah.
I was a political reporter. I spent a lot of time asking voters what they thought about our current president's sexual allegations and behavior, right, during the stories that came out. And I remember distinctly meeting a woman in Ohio who told me after the Access Hollywood tapes came out, well, I raised four boys. That's just locker room talk. Boys will be boys. And in her mind, there was absolutely nothing wrong with this. And she said, this is how my boys talk. And I raised four boys.
Yeah. I mean, what I would say to her is, this is how your boys talk because no one has ever expected differently of them, right? That we really can expect differently from boys and men. We really can. That they've gotten away with it this for so long because they've not been held to higher standards. And we can change that if we decide to.
You think it's possible?
Oh, 100% it's possible.
Do you think that we're... Okay, if your utopia is like a 10, where are we right now?
Where did we start? What's one?
Okay, let's say the 1960s, before the 1960s
revolution. So 1950s.
Sure, 1950s.
Like Mad Men, right?
Yeah, Mad Men era. If that was a starting point, where are we now?
I think we're like at a 3 or 4.
Oh, wow. So you think there's a ways to go?
I think there is absolutely a ways to go.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jacqueline.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
That's Jacqueline Friedman. Her new book is called Unscrewed: Women, Sex, Power, and How to Stop Letting the System Screw Us All. She'll be speaking at the Cambridge Public Library tonight in a talk presented by Harvard Bookstore. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Asma Khalid. This is Radio Boston.